and welcome to Talk About Jazz with Doug Hall. I'm your host, Doug Hall, and today our guest is Mike Neely, who is a jazz guitarist, composer, educator, and instructor. And as with all my podcasts, I want to give a short introduction and a summary of Mike's accomplishments and his resume. He is a graduate from Berklee College of Music in 1990, cum laude. Mike is a prominent educator and has taught guitar lessons through the Music Emporium in Lexington, Massachusetts for over 25 years. He has also taught at Berklee College of Music, Tufts University, Sharon Music Academy, and Bentley College. He's currently teaching at Phillips Exeter Academy. And Mike has performed with many jazz and blues greats, including Roy Hargrove, Antonio Hart, Tony Monaco, Bill Pierce, Joe Hunt, Barry Rees, Marty Rowan, Melvin Sparks, and Miana. He has also been a longtime member of the Ken Clark Trio, and we will be listening to a cut from that trio later on. So welcome, Mike. I appreciate you being here with us today. And one other area I wanted to cover was just some of your recordings, the albums recorded, particularly Eternal Funk and Mutual Respect for the distinguished Severn Records label. And you also are a longtime standing member of Michelle Wilson's Evil Gal Festival Orchestra. That's quite a mouthful. And have toured North America and Europe, and released the critically acclaimed album Wake Up Call from Michelle Wilson and her band on Rounder Records. So once again, we're very happy to have you join us here. I thought I would start just with an opening question about your journey or your opportunity that brought you to Berklee College of Music. I know that goes back in time a bit, but I think it's always interesting to have a little bit of a background story from jazz musicians.
Sure. Well, I mean, there's not too much of a story to tell. I was in high school and from Connecticut, New Haven. I decided at, one point I was going to go for it and, could just try to be a musician for, for my life and my career. And, there were a choice of several schools. And, after applying, I think I applied to like six. Or so I ended up, deciding on Berklee. I was glad that I did, and drove up with all my possessions and stayed in Boston ever since.
Right.
And
your experience, I mean, an overall sort of takeaway from an impact of attending that incredible music school?
Well, I had a lot to learn
right. When
I got there, and I certainly was in a position to learn it there. I was pretty good, at 17 or 18, 19. I thought I was pretty good,
right.
It's big fish in a very small pond in Connecticut and, went on to, played in sort of rock bands, some that did some touring, but when I say touring, I don't mean, not glamorous touring. I mean, like at that time, you could tour like hotel circuits.
Sure.
And they would have these, lounges where they would have music in the lounge. And, I was interested in jazz and creative music, but, I was pretty much a beginner to that. So after doing that for a couple of years after high school, I decided I need to try something else.
Sure.
It was okay. It was a good experience,
okay.
But, it wasn't leading anywhere and it wasn't musically what I wanted to do. And that's what got me over to Berklee.
Got it.
Okay.
Good. Okay. I mean, often it's a kind of a game changer for a lot of musicians. So that's why I ask. Certainly I'm going to ask you a little bit about mentorship later on in the interview, but let's go directly to the Ken Clark Trio. Before we cue up the first cut, which is Always Tomorrow. And if you could just fill us in a little bit on the background and history and your connection with Ken Clark and how that developed.
Sure. I can do that. So I met Ken when we were both at Berklee.
Ah,
Okay. Probably sometime around, let's say 1988. I ran into him, you know, shortly after we had both graduated, and played with him a little, just casually. I mean, mm-hmm. like at home, you know, mm-hmm. We were both like making our way at that point, trying to figure out, you know, just out of music college, not, you know, not having a record deal flung at either one of us. Right. So, and it's funny, he was playing like very old fashioned at the time keyboards, mm-hmm. that nobody at that time seemed to be doing, at least not so many people. He had an organ in his apartment, mm-hmm. and, an actual organ. And he had a Rhodes. And I was like, who is this guy playing an organ? Like nobody's doing, because in the '80s, those things temporarily went out of style.
Right.
Until people realized that there's nothing that really duplicates the sound, you know, quite, you know, if that's going to be your feature instrument.
Absolutely.
So, we started playing together and we started doing some, he had a band. It was a little bit more of like an original project, and I was doing jazz gigs, and sometimes I would hire him, and you know, he would hire me for this original band that he had, and the people I were playing with were not very reliable. Mm-hmm. And I would book the gigs and I would have to hope that they were going to show up.
Okay.
So I liked playing with Ken, so I did some of the gigs with him, and you know, it was around that time that I said, you know, he was just playing piano and we had a bassist, and I said, geez, you know, all these records I have of Wes Montgomery and Kenny Burrell and Grant Green, they've made all these records in the 60s, you mm-hmm. know, with organists like, you know, Jimmy Smith and, you know, Jack McDuff as organist. So I said, you know, why don't we try that, you know, and with him playing the bass. And that went well. He, you know, he developed into quite an organist and bassist. I mean, he was already mm-hmm. very good at the time, but like now he was, you know, doing the full organ setup where he's, you know, he's playing bass. And we did a variety, you know, one thing I think that helped us work a little is we, you know, I was kind of doing a lot of straight ahead swing jazz, but with Ken, we started doing some funkier things and experimenting with different kinds of grooves. And, you know, from there, we stuck together pretty much since early 90s.
Right.
I guess I'd have to say.
Okay.
And you know, from there we were just gig pigs. Mm-hmm. We would play. I could remember a time when I think I had a steady gig every night except Saturday.
Right.
And we had two gigs on Sunday, and Saturday I was always going to get another gig anyway. So I was basically working we were working all the time. Sometimes not for great money. Mm-hmm. And you know, also at that time it seemed to be a little bit more opportunity for the small time stuff. And we got picked up a few times by different vocalists who, you know, just they said, oh, this would be a good backup band. And
right.
we started, you know, sort of milking that. And we eventually got paired up with Michelle. Late 90s, I guess that would be.
Okay.
She had a band. She had mm-hmm. just made an album. Her band sort of broke up. And then we played with her, you know, someone arranged that we would do a gig with her. And that's, we've been doing it ever since.
Right. Well, I watched some live videos on YouTube of you two in particular, a lot of chemistry between you and Ken cooking back and forth, his super funk and that incredible sound of the Hammond B3 organ, and then you kind of exchanging with him and then the other players as well. It is a special sound, certainly.
Sure.
I'm thinking in terms of, not to go down a long road before we go to our first section, but I saw John Medeski play with Mark Rebo at Montreal Jazz Festival pre-COVID, and it was just them on the stage, and they just burned the stage down. It was scorching stuff going.
Oh, just the two of them, huh?
And a drummer, but you hardly even knew he existed.
Oh.
They just cooked for a set and kind of left the audience kind of with their mouths open, and that was my first exposure to John. So it's an amazing sort of relationship in jazz between that instrument, the Hammond B3, and say a guitarist in this instance.
Classic.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they did inventive things with it. Sure.
Oh yeah, he went down some roads. He went from jazz fusion to the Doors and Light My Fire and back.
Sure.
So it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
But yeah, it really made you, in a sense, really reappreciate the Hammond B3 organ sound. Well, why don't we move forward? Speaking of that sound, and we'll hear a little bit of Ken, but probably a bit more of you, as we've queued up Always Tomorrow with the Ken Clark Trio. Just some of the interplay we were just talking about between the Hammond B organ and the jazz guitar. It just there's so much warmth to the wood body electric acoustic guitar and that sound in your note playing. It just has that tone that's remarkable with that instrument and with the guitarist.
It's a nice blend with the organ, yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice blend with the organ, exactly. So, yeah, it really works. There's a wonderful swing and groove to it as well. And if we'd had a chance to listen to more of Ken, you could hear him take off. As he does, as I had a chance to listen to some of the YouTube live recordings of the Ken Clark Trio. Remarks or thoughts about hearing that again?
Well, it's not really. I mean, that's a recent recording. We haven't really finished. I mean, the album is complete, but it's just been the final mixing, mastering is mm-hmm. we're kind of these things. With everyone doing multiple things, they have to get done a little bit here and a little bit there. So it takes a while.
Of course.
I wrote that song. The writing of the song was not recent. It was probably like 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. But I never played it with anyone really. I just was going through old unfinished works and I knew we were recording this. And Ken's always very generous. You know, he said, bring your songs, even though it's the Ken Clark mm-hmm. organ trio, he spreads it around. He gives everyone this, it's more of a group effort, I guess you could say.
Yeah, well, that comes across certainly. Yeah, when I was watching the exchange of musicians, there was a female saxophone player as well in one of the YouTubes
I
watched.
That's Mayanna, yeah.
Okay. Oh, that's Mayanna. Okay, very good.
Yeah.
I'm glad I've given her
She's another
credit.
One who hired us.
Okay.
Who has hired us and to be, now we don't always... No, actually, yeah, we're going to be playing at Scullers, actually. I don't know if that's okay to give a little plug there.
Absolutely.
November 3rd at 7 p.m. It's Mayanna featuring the Ken Clark Organ Trio, which is basically her band, mm-hmm. and great vocalist Cassandra Wilson.
Oh, wow. Yeah, sure.
And so sort of a variety of sounds. We just recorded a new album with her mm-hmm. recently too, with Mayanna.
Okay.
So
great.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's do this. We're going to jump right into the next song, which is Wake Up Call. And now we're transitioning to Michelle Wilson's Evil Gal Festival Orchestra. So here we go.
Okay.
Let's have a listen. Take off on that lead, and I have to say, listening to Michelle Wilson for the first time, she has that really gutsy, bluesy voice that just works so well with that soulful R&B sound. And
yeah.
I know that she's somewhat of a household name, but you just can't know everybody. So I did go on the website and take a look. So again, there, evolution-wise, where do you two intersect with one another?
With Michelle?
Yeah, with Michelle.
Well, is that, in other words, the origins of?
Yeah, and how you came together. Yes. I mean, you're really a tight jazz group together on stage, certainly. So that kind of a breakaway a little bit from the Ken Clark Trio sound?
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Yeah.
It's a case where we found this little niche of people, vocalists or front people needing a band, and that's basically what happened. She had just recorded an album in New Orleans with her band at the time, and somehow shortly after the album was made, the bands one by one sort of fell apart.
Okay.
And so she had this album with no band, and we were paired up with her. We just played a little club up in Newburyport. As sort of it was an introduction. I really didn't know what was coming next. She enjoyed what we did. She just, she called, tunes that we would know, or she had music for them. And from there she asked us to be her band.
Oh.
And from there, and it was exciting because she was certainly a notch ahead of us on the music business totem pole, if we can.
Right.
I don't know if that's,
sure.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that was exciting for us. And we, that's where I really, when I refer to touring, most of the touring that I've done has been with her, or it's been with Ken and her. And then we made that album, Wake Up Call, which we made here in Boston, the one that track is the title track of.
Right.
It's interesting. I used to joke that this could be true of myself or even of Michelle or the band, is that I feel like I sometimes felt like I was too jazzy for the blues people and sometimes too bluesy for the jazz people.
Right.
And I don't know if that, that was just kind of a joke, but we were in that middle place. I mean, she considers herself a blues vocalist and she's, billed as such, but she's heavily influenced by people like, Dinah Washington.
Okay.
And Ruth Brown,
right,
who, Dinah Washington in particular, she spans all, from pop all the way over to blues, but she's, I think of Dinah Washington as a jazz singer.
Yes.
And, that's probably partly what made it work. We weren't that heavy, just straight blues sound, and we weren't that, just that straight jazz thing either.
Right.
And I think you could hear that in like everybody's playing in that group. I think usually I think it's a comment that I get occasionally is, oh, you sound bluesy, like if I'm playing jazz. So I have, that's a big part of it.
Right. Right. Well, tell me, just in a short answer, and then I'm going to cut to some questions about your education and your instruction as a jazz musician, particularly a guitarist. Clearly you've jumped between genres and you're comfortable with funk, blues, R&B, probably some fusion jazz. Do you call one of those genres your home in any way, or is what you enjoy the mix that's going on that has you play blues in one set and straight ahead jazz in the other?
That's a good question. Short answer, I'd say jazz.
Okay, right.
I mean, I love everything, but and just if it's creative and inventive, and there's improvisation involved. So I do play with a group that I wouldn't, another group I wouldn't exactly call jazz, but it's heavily composed and arranged, and there's, you know, great spots for improvisation, and it's challenging.
Got it.
So I like those. I like those aspects, but if I had to call home, I would say jazz, just personally.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, moving on to your background in education and instruction, we reviewed the different universities and colleges that you've been an educator and an instructor for in their music department. And I mean, I've had some music lessons myself and want to go deeper into jazz. I had played guitar in high school, and then I was taking pre-COVID jazz lessons from actually somebody who you know, Audie Bridges. And I've lost I've lost contact with him. But we went to when we went to remote guitar instruction, that didn't work. But I mean, it's such a fascinating subject, particularly for somebody from me who's writing about it and trying to learn it and understand it. So what do you find from students with obviously an incredible range of ability? What do you find that is most challenging for the student to learn about jazz guitar? I mean, as opposed to rock guitar or classical guitar, specifically jazz.
That's a good question. And the answer could apply to and other instruments.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Although it may particularly play out on the guitar. That's an excellent question. It's something I think about.
Mm-hmm.
And I find one of the challenging aspects is for showing someone how to improvise, which think about that. I'm showing you how to make it up. You are the one who's going to make it up. So, you know, I mean, it's so much about melody and hearing it. And hearing what it is that you want to play.
Right.
Now, it depends on the seriousness of the student and how much time they have to put into that. That's always like the answer. But I could take someone who can play guitar but doesn't improvise on jazz and just play an accompaniment for them to a tune. Say, okay, just play what you hear, play what's in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the person has no experience and doesn't even know what they're trying to listen for, it's not necessarily going to be very good.
Right. Sure.
So then we go, okay, well, let's discuss what key is it in, and what scales might be used, and what are the notes in the chord. And then it's difficult not for that, you know, to have it not come back and just sound like, okay, well, here I'm improvising, here are the scales and here are the chords.
Right.
In other words, it's a means to an end, and some people it's a little easier for some people to make that leap.
Mm-hmm.
So they're saying, okay, I do know what key I'm in, and I'm using that information, but I'm still playing what I hear. Like, okay, I know I'm in this key, I'm going to play the scale, then that's what it ends up sounding like.
Right.
So there's many famous players who had no formal instruction and would claim to not know what they were doing.
Right.
And of course, so that's possible, but that's really hard.
Yeah.
That means like someone like a Tal Farlow or a Stan Getz who claim somewhat this or Tommy Emmanuel. That means like hours and hours of, you just have to be driven.
Right.
And not only that, but it could be, you have to really want to do it to put a record on over and over and over again until you've somehow figured out what it is, and then do that over and over again until you've developed the language.
Right.
But that, if you had to choose between the two, that would be the only one that you would choose, because everything else detached from that doesn't have much meaning.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I would think of it in terms of when I had just some of my early jazz lessons with Audie Bridges, and I said, I'm in the shallow part of the pool, I'm shallow, and now we're going into the deep end, and I'm lost. But, you know, you just take it in steps. But it's a fascinating, The music is amazing, yes. And it's a fascinating language. Just closing Absolutely. Out quickly, we only have a minute or two left, but I thought I would just touch on, is there, obviously you have become a mentor to certain students, flipping that the other way around, is there somebody who stands out in your life that gave you a spark or direction or impacted you?
Well, there's a number, and I'll try to make it quick. Charlie Benakis. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know about Charlie Benakis.
Okay.
He was a prominent educator. He just taught private lessons, but he had like a 3-year waiting list.
Oh,
he charged a premium. He was teaching famous people people that became, you know, he was known, a very gifted instructor. He passed away a few years ago.
Okay.
And he made you work.
Right.
And, you know, you don't take lessons with him unless you are going to do the work. Otherwise, he'll just send you on your way.
Yeah.
But he was a great guy, great spirit. Nothing like, if you've seen the Whiplash movie, mm-hmm. I've had no experiences like that.
Okay.
None.
Good.
I'm not saying that, not saying that some people don't. I mm-hmm. know that some people have.
Right.
So, John Damian, another, I had him at Berkeley, and I really, you know, he's just local. I really should try to connect with him more, but I credit him for a lot of great ideas about ear and development. And he was kind of over my head at the time, I guess, I would say.
Right.
You know,
that can be a good thing.
I still retain a lot of the things that he showed me, and that he stands out. I hate to leave anybody out, but yeah, those are a couple that really stand out in my mind.
Well, great. And again, you can certainly, if you'd like, give, as we close here, a plug for where you're playing next. I think you said you're at Scholars. Is that upcoming this week?
Yeah, it's Scholars. No, that's in that's November 3rd.
Okay, very good.
Tomorrow night, I'm at the Beehive with Michelle Wilson.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Beehive in Boston, that's on Tremont Street.
Okay.
It's a 10 o'clock show, so it's like the old days. It's a late, late night.
Okay.
Great. I think those would be, we're playing at the Porch in Medford with the Ken Clark Organ Trio with a chromatic harmonica harmonicist named Shane Sager, who's usually on tour with Sting, but he's doing some local gigs, and he's hired us once again to be his backup band. And I regularly play at a little brewery in Beverly called the Backbeat Brewery. On like 2 Fridays a month, you could see either me or me with Ken.
All
so there you go.
Very good. Well, look, Mike, we're at the end of our interview, and again, I want to thank you so much for participating and being available, and
thank you.
All the best moving forward with your performances and recordings in your career.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for joining us.